Welcome, Spartans, to Spartan Up the Podcast, the podcast dedicated to getting you ripped off the couch, getting you out and exercising daily so you can be a better Spartan. All right, today's show is a little bit special because we've got a special guest with us here today. We've got ex or former world championship rower or world champion rower, Josh Crosby. So Josh is here.
Hi, guys.
He's joining us. We've got, as always, Joe DeSena over here to my left, CEO and founder of Spartan. Of course, I am retired Colonel Tim Nye. We're missing Sephra the Seed Huntress and Johnny Waite and Dr. L. They've all taken off and left us. But today's episode, we're going to be talking about a guy I watched many, many times on TV, a real rugged individual, bad MF'er out there, the Dean of Mean, Keith Jardine.
Yeah, I ran into him. I was at a conference, and he had a cool knitted skull cap on, and he looked like a caveman. That's the first thing that entered my mind, and a badass. Right, yeah. Well, caveman in general would be badass, right? And I had to go. I was attracted to him. I had to go over and start talking to him, and I dove in. You know MMA a lot better than I do, Colonel Nye. I don't know how much you know about MMA, Josh.
Enough to know that I wouldn't get in the ring because I'd get destroyed.
And Joe, I know I watch it on TV. That's the extent of my knowledge.
Yeah, so I got over to him, started talking to him. Turns out, as most MMA and wrestling and combat sports individuals, even the best of the best, they're really pretty humble, nice creatures, even though they look like they're going to rip your head off.
Yeah.
For some reason, I don't know, maybe you've got something we can get into after we watch the show.
Yeah.
But
I got some ideas.
But anyway, He's gonna teach us how to pivot, right? And actually, you pivoted in your career
a few times.
Yeah, I mean, you were a world champion rower, and then what happened?
Then I did not make the 2000 Olympic team, and I thought it was all over. I thought I was going to take a year off and maybe get back into it for the next cycle. And
don't give away too much.
Totally pivoted.
The point is hard to do.
Yeah,
and he's going to teach us. He's going to teach us a little bit on how to do that during this interview, and who he is, where he came from, and how he got it done.
All right, and stick with us through the interview. When we get done, we're all going to come back and kind of chew it up a little bit and talk about some of the lessons that Keith put forth and then see how you can apply them to your own life.
All right, we are here for Spartan Up Podcast, and we are drinking caveman coffee. I'm not even a coffee guy, and I'm pretty drawn to this can. It's pretty badass, and I'm drawn to this guy. What's your story? Where'd you grow up?
Man, I grew up in Oregon, actually, a really small town in Oregon. Really small. No movie theater, no fast food restaurants, anything like that. Then I moved to L.A. to live with my dad in high school, and that was...
On a farm in Oregon?
No, in the middle of the town. And it was kind of reversed there. Like, we should think, like, the people that lived out in the farms, those are all the rich folks. The poor folks lived in town.
Got it. So you're a big guy. You remind, like, if I had to guess, your dad was a logger or a farmer or something.
Miner.
A miner, okay.
Come from a real town. Well, half my family were miners, other half were loggers. So I got...
And parents split at a young age?
Yeah.
Dad goes to L.A.?
Yeah.
When did you leave to go with him?
My freshman year of high school, and it was always my dream to live with my dad. Like, I always had a relationship with my dad, and finally my mom agreed to let me go then. And so I moved from small little town to big town in L.A., and I thought I was in the center of the universe there.
And brothers, sisters?
Older sister.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. She moved too, or no?
No, she stayed there.
She stayed?
Yeah.
So you get
that's an amazing story. I get it out another day.
But, all right.
Well, you're one of the toughest people I know in my life.
You get to L.A. and bright lights.
Yeah.
What are you thinking?
I'm just like a little kid. Like, you know, and even then, my dad was in a bad area. Like a lot of, a rough area. And, like, I don't know any better. Like, I'm going to practice with all my football gear and all this stuff. We're walking through bad neighborhoods and going across the... I forgot what they call it. There's a bridge I went to in the high school. You're not supposed to go cross that bridge. And all these bad folks types playing handball, whatever. I didn't know any different. I'd walk back there, and people thought I was just this crazy white kid from Oregon.
So there was, and football was the sport?
Football and wrestling, man. Wrestling's what really did it for me.
When did you start wrestling?
I started wrestling in middle school in Oregon, which gave me a lot of confidence in California. I was just this really shy, man, incredibly shy kid. Like, didn't know any better. Even just that we just did this talk in public right now, man, like, that would have killed me a long time ago. Anyways, this really shy kid, but I played football, and I did pretty good in football, but then wrestling, I come from a background in wrestling, where wrestling is a lot tougher in Oregon than California. And I remember the big bully in the varsity football team, he wrestles too, and they're gonna pick on the new guy. And, hey, Keith, let's get a match with you. You and they called him Bob Moose at the time, and he looked like a Bob Moose. And I took him down right away, made him look pretty silly.
How long had you been wrestling at that point?
I started wrestling in fourth grade in Oregon.
Okay, yeah. You started young. Yeah. So that was it. You were the man, the big man on campus?
No, I was definitely not the man. I was still just a shy kid, couldn't talk to anybody, whatever. I was just the...
But you had confidence.
The confident, strange man that nobody wanted to mess with.
Right.
Yes.
You know, my wife always says, "What our boys make sure they wear the headgear. Make sure they wear And I say, you know what? I say it's better that they have up ears because nobody will mess with them.
That's right. And in fighting, it's a real thing, especially at the beginning when I was fighting. It's the beginning of the sport.
Yep.
If you see a guy that doesn't have messed up ears, like, that guy hasn't put his time in. Like, that's definitely
you got to see the bad ears.
Yeah, it's definitely like medals. Yeah.
So it's interesting because, I mean, obviously Pennsylvania wrestling is it, or Iowa, right? And so you go to California, there's not much going on there. So what'd you do?
I got my first year in wrestling, I got second in city, wow. L.A. City, which wasn't one to, no, I got second and first the next year. And then that was it, man. All I knew how to do was train for sports and all that and watch movies and hang out with my dad. That was life for me.
That was it?
Yeah.
When did you start working?
I got a football scholarship to move to New Mexico. Really, another small. Now I'm back to a small town again. I go to northern New Mexico to play football. I went to a junior college in LA, and I went to the rest of my college in northern New Mexico, a small little school. And so I got my degree in human performance there, and I'm playing football. I end up coaching the football. I was a defensive coordinator there at the college, probably the youngest defensive coordinator in the country at that time. I was a co-defensive coordinator, and.
So you're smart too. I mean, you did that at a young age.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. Well, I mean, and there was a point, that's what led me to. I think it was my third year of coaching, and I was still really young. I felt like I still had to be an athlete, and I was watching my linebackers move and set up, and I was almost like a jealousy of them. Not a bad, toxic jealousy, just like. Like it's still something in me, but then I started getting into bar fights again. Well, not really. And then, like, picking fights. Like, it's not really my personality.
Yeah. Why do you think you were picking fights?
I think just that outlet, that testosterone. That.
Yeah.
There's other reasons too.
I mean, it's a confidence thing too, right? You want to prove something.
Yeah. Yeah. I've always had to, coming from a small town, coming from nothing, coming from whatever, and not being. Very verbal. I always had to prove something. Like, I'm not going to talk my way. I'm not going to talk you down. There's only one chance I got.
Sure.
So.
How long did it take to realize that was not the ideal path?
Well, it didn't take me that long. I one night, like, I picked a fight with a guy for no reason at all, and you know, did well in that. And then the next day, actually, it was the day before a football game. The next day, I was. At around the football field, and my friends were playing in a rugby game. There's a rugby thing, and then I got to do something. They always asked me if I wanted to play, and absolutely I want to play. So I got into rugby, and then
you're built like a rugby player.
Yeah, they always said get the ball and run forward, and I can do that, man. And so that got it out, and then I realized I needed to be doing something. And at the same time, the other football coaches thought I was crazy because I would just show up. And I don't know why, I just knew I had to do it. I would go to Colorado Springs, I'd drive up there and go up to these amazing wrestling tournaments, like World Class, the Dave Schultz Memorial Tournament, where all the Olympic teams are there.
Sure.
And I would just show up and wrestle at these tournaments unattached. And they'd have like so-and-so versus from the Ukraine versus this bum over here is unattached. And you know, I wouldn't do very
well. You do well?
No. No, I would. But I just needed to compete, and all the other football coaches thought I was crazy driving up there doing this thing.
But wrestling was in you.
Yeah, just that fight. I needed, I don't know, I guess I had to prove something inside myself. I had to let something out. It just...
And that leads to MMA?
Yeah, yeah.
How old were you when that started?
Man, I don't even like to think about age. I was started late. I was in my late 20s, 28, something okay. around there. So there's a guy in the local rec center that I would actually use that. I would use his people to help me train for wrestling for those tournaments.
Sure.
And he was actually trained under Greg Jackson, which is a big trainer. And this is around 99, 2000.
Okay.
He was a big trainer in Albuquerque, New Mexico at that time, but still the sport's so young. Anyway, I trained with one of his disciples, started beating him right away, and like I really have a knack for this. And I always had a dream of mine from like watching Bloodsport and all these things, like what would it be like to actually fight people in a competition, like be a Rocky, you know? I wanted to be a boxer, I wanted to fight, I wanted to test myself that way.
More than wrestling, something a little more aggressive.
Yep. No rules. And that feeling just to step into a fight, I wanted to know what that like. Like it's easy, like talking about a bar, someone disrespects you or
Or you're whatever. Provoked. Yeah. But as opposed
it's
to
it's easy to get up and go out. Right. Like, you don't have to think about it. But then to do all that, fight somebody else that's training to fight you and do that whole thing and walk up and do it in front of all your mates. Camaraderie might have a lot to do with it too, fighting in front of your mates and showing off in front of you, the old man, that kind of
thing. Yeah, could be.
Anyways,
something to prove.
Exactly, always had something to prove. And then, so then I moved up to Greg. I met Greg Jackson once and said, that's it, I'm going to move to California. I'm done with coaching. I'm going to give this fighting thing go for a year. And I'll do that or join the military. It was one or the other to pay off my student loans. And so I'll give this thing for a year, maybe then I'll join the military later. And then a year became 2 years, became 3 years, and we went fighting.
Where was the first fight?
My first fight was in Denver, Colorado. Winklejohn got me that fight. Mike Winklejohn, if MMA fans will know who he is. I was training with Greg, going to grappling turns, doing a lot of jiu-jitsu, doing that thing. I won some good grappling tournaments. And can we cuss on this?
Yeah, you say anything about
that. Shit or get off the pot. Like, yeah. I know this friend's promoting a fight in Denver, and he's looking for a matchup for this guy, and I'm going to fight this guy.
What size is he? Is he your size?
It's 205. The weight is 205. And he fought in Pride before, and he's a pretty well-known guy. They're bringing me in and get beat up by this.
So you are Rocky in this case. That's Apollo Creed.
Yeah, for sure. Right. And
you trained? You ready?
Yeah, I'm trained. Oh, I can take this further. I trained. I'm ready. I tore my rotator cuff. I separated my collarbone like 3 weeks before the fight. And back then, like, it's still a fight. Like, I'm going to go do the fight. Like, I tried to do a push-up. I only ran the last 3 weeks. All I could do was run.
I had
my arm in my pocket.
So you're going in with a bad shoulder.
Yeah. I tried to do a push-up for the first time that morning. Couldn't do it. So I find this guy named Amir Renovardi, and he's a really well-known guy. The guy's kid, Bash Rutten's protege, and Bash Rutten's like a big star then from Japan and stuff. And so I go take him down, armbar him right away, break his arm, turn his arm backwards, and won that fight. I think he might have got paid a few thousand for that fight. I got paid $200 for that fight, $100 to show up, $100 to wins. I got paid $200 for that fight.
How'd you feel?
Thought it was amazing. I bought everybody dinner.
Nice. With the $200.
Yep. I thought it was greatest, man. Because we fought back then. That's what's cool. There's a whole generation. The reality show hit, and people made it really big, and became like, now people want to be like the next John Jones. They want to be the next superstar. And there
was a lot more raw when you went in.
We just wanted to fight, you know. We wanted to fight other people trained to fight, and we saw too many movies and sumo samurai stuff and all that, and we wanted to do that. And that's all it was about for us back then.
Let's take a break. Why don't you and I go fight?
Okay.
And we'll come back and finish this up.
Oh, let's see how it goes.
All right.
I hope you're not sitting still while you listen. If you are, you better get a burpee break in.
Dude, you're a lot tougher than I am.
You got me, man. It hurts.
I'm psyched you didn't break my arm.
Yeah, sure.
So you win that fight. You buy everybody dinner. Then what? This is your new life?
Ah, man, really? Where are we at there? You know, I'm super proud. There's another fight happening in Albuquerque, and fighting is so raw then, the big arenas. I remember, and still, like, I remember just being in the hometown, everybody being in the ring and everybody chanting my name, Keith, Keith, Keith. That was such a big deal for me, man. Like, I'm really doing, I'm not making any money. And no, there's UFC's barely a sport back then. And
it was still raw, like we said.
So yeah. We're still doing that thing. Yeah. Then I fight overseas a couple times. I fight in Japan, and these are amazing stories I like to tell sometimes.
Tell me. How'd you do in Japan?
You
land in Japan. You nervous?
Heck yeah. Almost like the first fight, like that whenever they bring you somewhere to fight somewhere else, especially in those days, they bring you in to lose.
Yeah.
And I land in Japan 3 days before my fight.
You're a gimme, in other words. They're just throwing you in the ring.
Yeah. I'm fighting the former Pancrase champion.
Right.
He's a well-known Japanese guy. And so I land there, and I'm having trouble with a new weight class. It's 198. I've never made 190. I've been 198 since, I don't know, my first year of high school.
Wow.
And so then they change everything. First of all, we're only there 3 days before, which is short. Then we get, by the way, we change weigh-ins because we got to go to Osaka to fight. We change weigh-ins to the day of the fight, which is pretty unheard of. Always the day before, you have 24 hours to recover.
Sure.
So then my whole...
You think they were fucking with you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's what they do.
Set up because this guy had to win.
They knew that the whole time. And,
right.
And. And so my whole experience of when I first got there was pretty much cutting weight. So
no sushi.
Yeah, I didn't really eat any good food. My trainer did, and I made him eat a lot of stuff, Greg Jackson. I eat that. Tell me how that is. And then, so I spent the whole day before the fight cutting weight all day long. And then the next morning I wake up, I'll cut the rest. I'll cut all morning. I cut on the train all the way there. I get to the fight. I miss the first weigh-in. I'm pound over.
Fuck.
Yeah. And then.
Did they give you more time or?
Well, it was about 2 hours before the fight, I think, maybe 2.5.
Yeah.
It was really close when we weighed in before the fight. It's a weird event. It's in a hotel. Yeah. It's not like normal fights. And so I made a steam room out of my bathroom, turned the shower on, steam room, and a random place there, and lost the extra pound. Like an hour and 20 minutes before my fight, I stepped on scale, made weight. So now,
what'd you eat?
Yeah, that's a thing. Is what can you eat? You're going to fight. You don't want to fall. I just remember laying there on the ground. I'm here in Japan. I have no energy. My body's just drained. Like, how am I going to do this? I got to walk out in front of all these people and do this fight. And then my buddy, well, he's my buddy now. I didn't know them. Nate Marquardt, another well-known fighter. He was fighting too. He brought me what's that stuff? Pedialyte or something like that.
Sure. Yeah.
So I drank a little bit of that, more of that, and it just like I remember laying there. I remember feeling my like left leg first. And I remember doing my left leg first. Oh, there's a little bit of energy. Oh my God. And then there's a little bit of energy, and then it built up till I did a lightest warm up because I didn't have any energy to spend. I walk out to the fight. My face, you can see on the video, like my face is all sucked in.
Sure.
I go out to the fight and I fight their form. And then they was messing with you. I remember they announced me first in the ring. I'm standing in the ring. It took him maybe 10, maybe 15 minutes to come out to the locker room just because they're trying to.
I tell my kids, I say, you don't have to go out to the mat in the circle first. Wait, let him stand out there.
That's right.
Right?
Be relaxed. Anyway, so I get out there and we do the fight. And maybe a little bit anticlimactic because it was a draw. I didn't lose a fight. I had a draw with a former king.
Take a draw.
Yeah.
How did you feel?
Felt amazing, man. Then I got to experience Japan. Everybody was so beat, they went to bed, and I just walked around Japan until sun up, going in little bars, having sake.
It's a crazy place. I just lived there for a year. It's a crazy place.
I really want to go back just to enjoy it.
Whenever you want to go. I got a whole bunch of friends there.
Yeah?
Yeah, whenever you want to go.
Yeah. My fiance fights in the UFC now, too.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I did that one. And then I fought in Russia, which is another crazy experience. And I won that fight against the guy they brought me in to lose. I armbarred him, too, in the first round.
Nice.
And that was like the crowd going crazy for him, booing me when I come out. And then all my best wins seem to be this way, and then just dead silent after I armbarred them.
Because they don't know who you are.
Yeah.
So you really are like the real life Rocky of MMA, right? This bad boy, unknown.
I would like that. I never really thought about it before, but maybe Rocky won where he didn't win the title.
It's close.
Yeah. Because I've beaten a lot of champs in my day. I've beaten Chuck Liddell. I've beaten Forrest Griffin. I've beaten a lot of the big names, but they never had the title when I beat them.
Got it.
So I did that fight, and then I got called onto the reality show, which was definitely not my personality. I didn't want to do it. Like, that seemed like death to me, to be on a reality show. But that's what it takes to have a career in this sport. I'm going to do
it.
Because season one was success, and I was on season two, and that got me in the UFC.
Nice.
And then
you had a good run.
I had some. I tell people I have some of the most spectacular wins, like the ones I've described. Like when I beat Chuck Liddell, it was a similar situation. Turned the crowd, that kind of thing. And people hated me at first and loved me afterwards. And well, Bonner was the same way. Forrest Griffin. One of my favorite fights of all time was Quentin Jackson. I lost that fight, but still one of my favorite fights of all time. And just because it was.
Why?
Man, it was back and forth. I was just surviving the whole time. We were just fighting, man, and I didn't know if I was winning. I didn't know if I was losing. I just knew I was surviving, and I got to keep attacking, or else he's going to attack me back. And it was like that. And Quentin's told me too is one of his favorite fights. And then it gets
What did he say at the end of the fight to you?
Actually, I ran into him years later. Yeah. He told me. One of his favorite fights he had, and you're a real warrior and all that stuff, and I really, really respect that. I got knocked down in the last 10 seconds of the fight. That's what lost me the fight. One of the judges came up to me and said, I had you winning before that, which I had no idea where I was in the fight, so I knew there was 10 seconds left. I got to go for it, man, because this is my only chance. And then he clicked me with something. I fell down to my knees and came back up, and it lost me the fight. Yeah, but whatever. I don't
care
about
that. You play that tape, or you're cool?
No, I'm cool with that because I fought the fight. I lost to Vanderlei Silva, got knocked out in the first, first minute of the fight, I don't even know. I never fought him. I zigged when I should have zagged and got caught on the chin, and that was it. And so I still don't know what it's like to fight that legend of the sport, you know
sure,
what I mean?
Sure,
that's all about the fight for me. I never cared about the titles or anything. I just wanted to get in that fight that the fans loved and all that. I was saying to you, I had the most spectacular wins and those most spectacular losses at the same time.
No, it's good. It's good. What's from there? Caveman Coffee?
Yeah, as I said in that talk we just did, I dropped down to the dumbest thing I've ever done is I thought that, well, I fought everybody in my weight class, so maybe I'll try 185 and that'll make people interested in me fighting again. I'll get back into the UFC that way. And so I lost a lot of weight to fight at 185. And I, even my diet that wasn't great as it was, got a lot more, I accentuated that. And now I'm running every day just to lose weight. I'm training just to lose weight, not even fight. And I became a walking old man, and I fought two fights that weren't even, I don't even count them as fights.
Because you were an unhealthy weight.
I couldn't move, man.
Yeah.
I couldn't move.
Yeah.
And the last one was a guy that I matched up really well against, and my coach told me that I needed to think about retiring because I took a pretty good pounding against this guy. And again, I physically couldn't move. I couldn't react. And then that led into a period of my life where, like, what am I going to do now? I've always dreamt of acting, and that's what I want. I know that's what I want to do, but physically, like, I feel like death, and I'm walking in a coma every day, I'm depressed about money. I'm losing all this money flying out to LA for auditions and trying to make this career work. And I went through all my savings and all that trying to make this acting thing work, trying to make that happen. And then I met Tate at an audition, my partner, Tate Fletcher, and he starts telling me about how are you feeling, how's your diet and all that. And he's asked me about that before, but this time I'm definitely ready to listen. And then he starts telling me about paleo diet and gives me Mark's book and Rob Wolf's book and I dive into that, and it's the most freeing thing I've ever done in my life, and it's just like,
just gave up sugar.
I gave up sugar and I learned how to fast. I learned how to be in control of my food,
right.
and also, like, I'm a foodie, man, but I learned how to enjoy food more than I've ever enjoyed food in my life. Everyone talked about diet. They always say, like, I they're special. They love food more than the next person or whatever. You don't love food more than me, I promise you that. Yeah. And so I learned how to control it and how to enjoy it and how to eat within certain parameters, and I became more healthy. People, I go into practice now, and I'll beat up people fighting in the UFC right now without even training.
Just because of your diet?
Just because I'm healthier. Yeah. I'm healthier than I was, and a lot of the stuff kind of stuck with me as far as training. And Anyway, that what was the question? How that turned into coffee?
Well, that leads to coffee.
Yeah, because and then me and Tate. Now I'm just going around telling everybody that'll listen about. I have yoga studio too, and I'll sit with people for a long time after class when they ask me about diet and like I'm not an expert, but this is my path. This will lead me somewhere. Now I'm trying to tell everybody to go do your own research and find it out. But it's all out there.
Sure.
And here's where you need to look. So I'm preaching that and Tate's already has a coffee business. I found a coffee bean that was unique, and we started selling that almost as a way to promote what we're talking about. Like I don't know, they both fed off each other, and that grew into like a hobby that we're selling coffee and we're showing up to. It's cool because it got me in the room with people like you, and it got me into Paleo FX, meeting Mark Sisson and Rob Wolf, and now I'm meeting all these people that helped change my life.
You had an actual product.
Yeah, exactly. Now we're in the conversation.
Yeah.
And then now recently the product's actually gaining wheels and momentum, and because a couple of things we did with our suppliers and things and changing the product and all that. And now it's like, now it's a real business. Now it's like, uh-oh, how do we keep up with this thing?
Yeah, now, okay. Now you're pregnant.
Yeah.
With triplets.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm psyched that you spent time with me. I'm glad you didn't break my arm. I'm excited to try some coffee.
Yeah, so and, now do I got to run a race with you?
Now you got to run a race with me. We're going to do a race. Where do you live right now these days?
Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Perfect. I'm going to get you to a race.
And we're gonna high altitude.
Yeah.
It'll even out a little bit. We'll go uphill somewhere. All
no
right.
Problem. You're the man.
Thanks, man.
Thanks. All right. What do you think?
Well, I think he is exactly what you think he is, right? I mean, his persona is out of the ring, pretty much what it is in. Well, I'll take that back. I mean, he's not aggressive outside the ring. But, I mean, just looking at the guy, he looks like a guy that you might want to walk around or walk on the other side of the street. I mean, he looks like a tough guy, and he is a tough guy.
Yeah, you wouldn't mess with him. But surprisingly, you go to shake his hand. I spent time with him. I actually flew to Japan with him. And he's pretty humble. He's pretty grounded, like a lot of the fighters we meet.
It seems to, like, when I watch them on TV, that humble side seems to come out almost instantaneously after some of these fights where they beat the crap out of each other and then they're hugging each other at the end, really genuine handshakes, and it blows my mind how...
You drop all that.
Yeah, they drop that. They go into the ring and battle it out, and then they're professional. No, I can't say all of them, but they're professional and pretty humble.
Were you like that in rowing?
Yeah. I mean, when you're on the water and you're in the middle of a race, it's a completely different thing than afterwards. And a lot of times you might race against someone in college, but then end up being their teammate on the national team in the summer. So you gotta watch it. You might be pulling for them and they may be pulling for you come that summer when it comes for the tryouts. So you gotta be respectful.
Military like that?
Well, it is, but but let me just back up a little bit. I think that humility part comes out a little bit more so in individual sports than probably team sports. You know, you see a lot, if you watch a football game at any level, you see a lot of the trash talk back and forth, and it's actually even encouraged, right? Or at least by the sportscasters and a lot of the fans. But on an individual one-on-one sport, listen, when you walk across a mat or you shut that door on an octagon, you don't know. I mean, Mike Tyson got beat, right? I mean, you might just get your ass kicked that day, so you might as well just be humble. I have seen in college wrestling now, they're starting to promote a little bit more of the trash talking, and it never used to exist, but they're trying to make it more popular. But I think that humility comes out because, okay, I just did my best, and you just kicked my ass. I mean, what do you expect me to do? Get jump up and down
the other
and
thing is
my
you,
chest?
You can't hide behind the team.
Right.
And I think a lot of times on the field, you can be a total jackass and then go kind of get behind the lineman or something
right.
like that.
Absolutely.
It's a little different.
And then when you asked me about the military, I was thinking as you were talking, I mean, professional militaries from the dawn of time have respected one another, even unprofessional, meaning, you know, you don't have to be a foreign military. You know, I mean, we've been at war now with Al-Qaeda, Taliban, ISIS, whatever, for what, 19 years now. I mean, there are some hardcore fighters there, and you'd be foolish not to think so, right? So you can respect them and still go to war with them, shoot them, kill them, whatever. Doesn't mean there's hatred. You don't need that. You're fighting, and you can respect your enemy.
Respect the enemy. I think that's what we learned here with Keith. The other thing is pivoting. You've had to pivot out of the military career.
Yes. Well, yeah, I had to. That's a good way of putting it there. I said, hey, 32 years, man, you got to go. You know, they kind of kicked me out.
How hard is that?
Well, it's very hard, especially the longer you put into something. I think probably the harder it is to leave, or maybe even the more attachment you have to it, right? I mean, in the military, everybody taps out sooner or later. It's just a matter of when it happens, right? It's coming, and you know it's coming. So I think maybe if you're a professional athlete, you know, one day you're on top of the world, the next day you hurt your elbow and you need Tommy John surgery, and you're not playing anymore, that may be a tougher transition.
How about you, Josh?
Mine was pretty quick. I mean, I had the in the back of my head that I could take a year off and then maybe jump into the next cycle, but I was already, you know, 10 years into serious training and racing, and it's hard once you've had a few, you know, defeats and kind of a fall from, I mean, I was on the team 4 years and then I didn't make it. That's a real blow. But I did take some time off, and then I shifted into some other stuff, and I took my energy, my talent, my hard work, my fitness, mental strength, everything, and then channeled it into.
How many people can't do that, right? I had a pivot from Wall Street, but it was an easier pivot. I had made some money, and so you could, right? That's an easier pivot.
But I don't know if it is easier, because you had to leave something you were doing for a long time and also do something drastically different. So money or no money.
Yeah, but having money gave you
makes it easier.
Some security.
Yeah.
But I don't think making money, I don't know, tell me if I'm wrong, was that your goal? If it was, you'd still be.
I wanted to make a number. I wanted to make some money so that I wouldn't fight with my family the way I saw my dad and my mom fight. So I had a goal there. You wanted to make the Olympic team. I don't know what your goal was in the military.
Yeah,
you wanted to be a general.
That might have been part of the problem.
Well, that's interesting what you're saying there, right? Because I'm sure Keith had on, you know, he had his mind set on.
I started as a private and worked my way up to sergeant. I had no aspirations ever of being a colonel. I mean, that was so far, you know. I remember at one point making a phone call, and I was talking to the headquarters up in the Pentagon, you know, and they said, look, you have to leave the job you're in. And I said, why? And they said, well, if you stay there, you'll never make colonel. And I remember laughing on the phone and said, did you ever think that was a goal of mine? I could care less about that. Well, it happened anyway, right? But, I mean, I needed a job. I had one.
That's a big question for us then in the audience that I'd like to pose, which is, you know, for the last 4 years, we've talked about this idea of setting a goal, etching it in stone, right? Chanting that mantra so you get to where you're planning on going. But should we? Or because if your goal was so finite towards getting on that Olympic team and then you don't, are you you know?
I think it depends on your DNA, right? So there's plenty of people who you know, weren't able to pivot maybe, or they weren't willing to take that risk that would really allow them to find something on the next path that was as fulfilling and full of passion and whatnot. So I don't know. But some people are okay with going as hard as they can and then shutting down. And that's okay, too, in some ways, if they're happy.
How do you want to ask the audience? Maybe they can come back to us because...
Well, you know, when you were talking, I was thinking it's that old thing about if you have a goal without a plan, it's just a dream. You know, so there's a little bit difference there between setting a goal, an actual aspiration, and just kind of, well, my dream one day is to be the world champion, right? But I'm sure you had a plan, a set of...
Yeah, and the plan would change, though.
Yeah, right, yeah. Some subsets and everything else.
But is there a plan B? It's another thing we talk about, no plan B. And so all I'm saying is if you put everything into it, which is our mantra, that's what we say. Right. Put everything into it. Don't do anything that won't make the boat go faster. And then all of a sudden, the boat springs a leak, and you have focused on anything else, like
you got to swim to shore. You don't know how to swim.
But I think again, if your goal is to be the best you can be, you know, I mean,
and if you got to pivot,
if you take out world champion out of the title and say, I want to be the very best rower I can be, as opposed to being the best rower in the world, you make that a whole lot more obtainable and a lot more. What's the word I'm looking for? If you don't make it, you're going to make it, because if you know, you're going to know whether you try it hard enough.
I like
or
what
not.
You just said a lot, because I never set out to be a world champion. I became one because I was so focused on being the best I possibly could be every stroke.
All right, Colonel and I nailed the end. I like that, right? I'm going to be the
we
best.
We should still ask everybody in the audience what they think about it. Send their comments back to us. Contact us. And again, if we like what you said, maybe, you know, obviously we'll post it, but maybe one day we'll have you on the show.
By the way, if you are on the show, we show up in the middle of the night with a black van. We zip tie
That's
the hands
what
behind
to me.
And you just show up in an undisclosed warehouse, which is where we are now.
They left me actually for about 60 days. That gave me the hair growth and the beard. So
catch you later.
That was clean cut.
We want to hear from you. Tell me what you're applying, what you're not applying, what you're struggling with. Go to our Instagram account and be part of the conversation. Let's change the world together.